And good afternoon and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet and I am here in the studio with Laron Landis. Patty is still down in New Orleans taking care of Aaron's father. She will be back hopefully within the next few weeks. Our guests today are Driana Belden and Mersham George. They are from UNT. Driana is the assistant dean over at the libraries. Mersham is the senior director of development for the entire school or for the libraries?
For the School of Journalism.
We also have with us Pridge. You know Pridge because she was Grand Marshal of the Pride Parade this year, which is why Patty couldn't be here, the real reason.
They didn't want to share.
Couldn't have two Grand Marshals in the same room at the same time. Yeah, yeah. But Pridge is also the president of the Dallas Way. And the Dallas Way is a gay organization here in the city collecting stuff. What does that have to do with UNT? Well, let's find out. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having us, David.
Sure.
We're
glad you're here. Sure. Pridge, why don't we start with you? What is the Dallas Way? I know. She's looking at me like, oh, yeah, right. Start with me. Yeah. What's the Dallas Way?
We are a group of people, we call ourselves the Happy Historians, looking to collect material, stories, anything about the gay history of Dallas, the history of Dallas from the gay perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so you've collected a whole bunch of stuff. Now, what does that have to do, Driana, with UNT?
Well, as a university, we have extensive special collections that document the history of North Texas, every aspect of it. And a few years ago, we had the opportunity to work with Resource Center to get their LGBT archives that they'd had for some time. And so it just sort of started from there, and also from a relationship we started very early with Dallas Way in their efforts. We wanted to be their preservation partner to document and preserve this history and then provide access to it as well.
And most people will think this is odd, but one of the largest gay archives now in the country is here in Texas.
Yes, it is.
My alma mater.
And mine as well.
It's wonderful.
So,
yeah.
So how was UNT chosen? Because you did look at other schools.
We did. And I will tell you that, of course, the Resource Center, C.C. Cox came to us at a board meeting and said, here's what we're doing, and we've reached an agreement with UNT. And so we're going to send all of our collections there. And so that got us certainly to looking at UNT. We had looked at other colleges. We're called the Dallas Way, so we started with Dallas colleges. And very frankly, there wasn't a lot of interest from other colleges in what we wanted to do. And we had heard about UNT, obviously, from the Resource Center, but also from other areas about their technology and their openness and their willingness to do what it takes to get the job done. And so
you hooked up. Now, what is it about UNT that makes you really uniquely the right place for all this stuff here in North Texas?
Well, I think a number of reasons. We are very passionate about documenting the history of the area, and this is just an area that's under-documented in the South in general. Not a lot of places are collecting this important history, and we want to be a part of that, and we wanted to engage with the community and just gather as much of that history for, you know, all sorts of purposes for future research and scholarship. And I think another reason that we were the right place is we are just so uniquely situated with our technology platform, our digital library infrastructure, the information, the unique information that we put online that's available nowhere else in the world. And so I think we were able to talk with Resource Center and also with the Dallas Way and say, you know, we don't only want to do what every other library does, which is, you know, put this in preservation format so that it's going to be preserved for the future, describe it so people know what's in it, and also to let people come physically and access it as well, because anybody can come in and, you know, use these archives. But we also want to digitize it and put it online for free for the world to come in and search and use it. And so we've already started down that road, and we have further to go, too.
Okay, now you said the magic word that I see Mersham is kind of going, for free. It's not all that free, is it?
No, it's not. My role with the libraries primarily is to do the fundraising work, go out, meet folks, build relationships that in turn results in philanthropic support for the library and the Mayborn School of Journalism. But more specifically, all the work that is being done with the libraries and digitizing and archiving and preserving, their costs to it. And every dollar that comes in the door to support those hard costs makes the access even easier. I mean, we work highly with a lot of the platform in which the library folks are using, the things that they use to help digitize the works and make it accessible. It's not cheap by any means. So my role is to work with Drianna and the Dean of Libraries to really go out and seek the support that will help make it more accessible continuously.
What does it take to digitize, say, one page of, you know, you have a letter and you want that digitized? How much would that cost to actually take, digitize, preserve, because you're also preserved? And one of the things you didn't mention that UNT has is this wonderful storage facility for all of these things, so that it's not deteriorating over time.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it takes for a letter probably about $6, and that's basically us scanning a very high resolution master preservation file that we digitally preserve, and then also just putting it online, you know, hosting it on our platform so people can access it. And then each of those items has to be described. You know, what is this? Who is this letter from? So someone has to sit and type all that information in. So it's not when I said free, I didn't mean it was free for us. I meant it's free for the public. So, yeah. You know, we put out massive amounts of quantities of data, and we don't charge people to use that when we have things online in our digital libraries. But definitely there's costs involved. I mean, for the Resource Center collection alone, just the physical collection, that was over 400 cardboard boxes with stuff just put in it. So it all had to be organized. I mean, I know that we had 2 full-time people for a year working to organize that collection and describe it so that people would actually know what was in it. And also the cost of boxes to preserve it. I mean, there's a lot of expense. We have invested a lot of our funding into preserving this and our other collections that we have.
What kind of documents are you looking for, or can people contribute for this collection?
Absolutely. We're still, you know, very much building this collection. That's going to be going on, you know, in perpetuity, really. And so the kinds of things we're looking for are anything that documents the history and the culture of the community in North Texas. And that's basically, you know, photographs, papers, letters, just the stuff of history, newspapers, publications, and those types of things. You know, video or audio, anything that can be, someone can be used in the future, a historian or someone doing a documentary can use, that's the types of things that we collect.
Mm-hmm. And in addition, some things that just seem, why would they want that? T-shirts. Because when the Dallas Buyers Club came to UNT and did some of their research, in the film, there were some authentic-looking T-shirts from the period that when I was watching the film the first time, I just started laughing. It's like, I have that T-shirt.
Exactly. They wanted to be very accurate in their portrayal of what Dallas looked like at that time, and so they did research in the archives to help with that. So.
The only thing they didn't do was make Dallas look like Dallas did at that time. They filmed it in New Orleans.
Oh, yes.
Back again, money. No, much cheaper to film in New Orleans. Can you talk a little bit about how receptive UNT was with the idea to even hold this collection?
We were very receptive from the very beginning. It really sort of started for us when a psychology professor at UNT, Mark Vosvik, who's in charge of the LGBT studies program, came to the libraries and said, hey, you know, Resource Center is looking for a home for this incredible collection that documents the community, that dates from, you know, the 40s to the present, and it's just incredible, and it should be accessible to people. It should be used. And he's like, would you guys be interested in talking with them about how that might work? And we were like, yes, absolutely. Let's go down and talk to them. And so we did. And it was a long conversation because, I mean, there's trust issues. You want to make sure you have something valuable that's so important. You want to make sure whoever you're partnering with is going to live up to the trust that you instill in them, or, you know, the hope for them. So, you know, definitely was a long conversation for us to get to know each other. And they were also talking to other universities and other places about being the potential home for this collection. And I think, you know, again, what sold them is just we see the importance of this collection. We wanted to do it. We have a passion for it. And also, I think the technology angle, you know, helps a lot as well.
On top of that as well, the University of North Texas is one of the most diverse and inclusive institutions in North Texas. Mm-hmm. So that helped make things more easy in the transition. As we continue to go forward, we see that being more and more prevalent at the institution, that we're growing by leaps and bounds, we're more diverse than many others in our area, and we are about inclusion. So that helps solidify the agreement.
Okay, Pridge, so with the Dallas Way joining in on this, you want everything to be in a place that's trusted, in a place that would be accessible. It's a Texas school. And that had to go through everybody's minds. I mean, and isn't that sad that it has, and that's no reflection on any of the people at UNT. It's more a reflection on how we feel about things that are from Texas.
It's a reflection of maybe our own homophobia. Mm-hmm. And what I was real impressed with, and the other board members were impressed with, was that they showed up at our meetings. Morgan and Sue Parker, Deandra, they were all there, and because they wanted to know about, you know, what we were doing, and they wanted to show us that they really wanted this to happen, and they were willing to take care of our stuff. And that was probably the most important thing for me. I was real impressed with their willingness to drive down to Dallas, you know, on a Tuesday night, and be willing to share with us what they could do for us.
So one of the things that you said, Driana, that you just kind of passed by, and I guess you said it like, well, this is a normal thing for a Texas school to have. My school had one in 1975 when I was there, but that's okay if it's just real new here. But you have one, an LGBT studies department.
Right, yes.
And you're saying, well, right, yes.
Well, when I was in school, and we talked about this before the show, there was talk of an LGBT studies program. I graduated. Now one has come, and that's great. Maybe both of you all can talk about this. Why is that even important to have that, to even talk about this history?
Well, it's important because we're all a part of this world, right? I mean, it's an important part of Dallas. It's an important part of Dallas history. I mean, the whole community, it's just so intertwined. You can't tell the story of Dallas without telling this part of history as well. So, I mean, you know, you have to try to preserve, you know, all the things that are going to be important for the future. And I mean, Dallas is such a huge LGBT population. I don't think people realize that. I mean, you know, on the West Coast and the East Coast, but Dallas is, I think, number 3 or 4 in the country. I mean, there's a lot of the LGBT community here is very significant and has made significant change. Yeah, and significant changes and really important things that have happened, you know, in history that need to be saved and preserved.
And, you know, I always find it interesting. I guess a lot, when I say kids, you know, maybe 25 and under, they don't realize.
Saying that because that's how old he was when he started on this show.
I was going to say.
He was the old guy.
Okay, so.
And so know how every time he refers to himself as old, I really appreciate that.
I'm grown. People, you know, don't realize that, first of all, gay is not a new thing. We've been around since AIR. And that our history is not a new thing either. It's not just, you know, even predates the AIDS crisis. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the history before?
Well, first I'd like to apologize because I know Driana's name and I mispronounced it earlier,
right.
And I know, and I'm so sorry.
No problem.
Trust me, I know what that feels like. I've said this 1,000 times, and it was first attributed to – nobody really knows who said it first, but – mostly it's attributed to Winston Churchill, and it's like victors are the ones who write the history. And so we as a group, as a people, have never been victors. And we've been persecuted and discriminated against in the same way that other minority groups have been discriminated against. And it's never written about. I can talk to that because I used to teach history, and I taught Texas history, and I taught American history and world history, and there's never any mention, of course I grew up in Texas, so there's never any mention of minority groups, much less gay and lesbian groups. For the longest time, I think, this is just my own personal opinion, I think that heterosexuality is the norm. That's not my personal opinion, obviously. But people assume heterosexuality. They assume that a person is straight unless they're proven otherwise. And so there was never felt to be a real need for other minorities to be included in history. And yet we have a really strong history. And we can go back to 1969 and talk about the Stonewall riots. But if you go back, if you look at our Facebook page and you look at Bruce Monroe and the things that he's gone way back in history to show us how far back we've gone, the things that we've done to try to get things. And if we don't do it, no one else is going to.
We're talking to Triana Belden, Mersham George, and Pridge about Dallas history, about preserving Dallas history, and we need to take a break. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here in the studio with Ron Landis. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Listen to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. Listen.
And that was Candy Markham. She's going to be on our show in 2 weeks. Next week we have Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson. If anybody has any questions for Congresswoman Johnson, just put those questions on our Facebook page. We'll be happy to answer
Absolutely.
Them. We love when she can come on, and she's coming on for Pledge Drive, and she knows it too. So let's see if she can help us with Pledge Drive next week. We are talking today to Triana Belden, to Mersham George. They are from University of North Texas, and they are archiving all of the gay history that we're throwing at them. Are you, and we're also talking to Evelou Pridgen. Everybody knows her as Pridge. She was Grand Marshal of the parade this year, but she's also president of the Dallas Way. Are you archiving our radio show?
No, but...
Okay, you need to.
Yeah.
that is certainly something that would be really interesting to have.
We actually have... Doc, you actually have digital versions of this better than just what we've uploaded to YouTube. So we need to hook you up because we have lots and lots of hours of us talking about absolutely nothing.
But before the break, we were talking about the history or just LGBT history in general and why it's important. Jana, can you tell us what's the oldest or longest back date document you've received so far?
I think we have some journals, and I can't tell you the title of them because I don't recall off the top of my head, but I know we have some magazines, I think, from the 40s. So,
wow.
Yeah, so there's some things that go pretty far back.
That's pretty impressive.
It is, yeah. It is pretty good.
Is there anything that you haven't gotten yet, and I don't mean a specific thing, but a big collection that you know of that's out there that you're still working on, other than the Lambda Weekly collection?
We're definitely interested in that. I don't know that we have anything specific that we're working on. I know that one of the things that we are working on the digital front is, last year, this summer, we put up the complete run of the Dallas Voice. And as far as we know, it still is the only complete entire run of an LGBT newspaper that's online, fully searchable, accessible in the country. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the process of doing that with the Oklahoman Gaily. And so I know that we are actively talking to other newspapers about hopefully having them join the fold. I would love to have a large LGBT news archive that even goes beyond Texas. I think that would be great. Because, I mean, there's a lot of power and a lot of momentum about having a lot of things in the same place on the same subject. I mean, you think about your traditional library. You walk in, there's tens of thousands of books. You can never really, even if you're a scholar, read all those, fully assimilate them, or what's in every book.
But I have.
David's done it. It's funny. When something is digital and all the words are part of the search that you can do, I mean, to just be able to pull a name out of a newspaper page or a name out of a magazine or, anything, it just makes it that much more powerful for everyone. One of the examples of that is one of our students up at UNT, Karen Wisely, has been working on her history dissertation in the Resource Center collection. And she is really speaks so highly to the fact that she can now her dissertation is so much more rich because she has access to this collection. She can go in every week and pull new boxes and look at things, and just a richer, broader, more in-depth.
I can tell you what it's meant to me. working at Dallas Voice, because we have online papers that go, or articles that go back to maybe 2006, when Dallas Voice upgraded its website one time. I'm sitting in the office typing, and I said, where's last week's paper? Where's they upgraded, and they didn't save what was on the website already, which was maybe 3 years, 4 years, and it was all lost.
All of it.
Do you know, it was like horror. How can I look up something just from last week? Until the archives were up, if I needed an article that dated back before that, because we did not have 30 years worth of papers sitting in the office, I had to go down to the main library, and they were great. You could say, I need the papers from May 1998, and they'd walk in the back, come back out, here they are. I mean, they had them beautifully preserved, whatever. And I'd open to the page, take a high res digital photo of it, and I'd go back to my office, and I had what I needed. It only took me an hour or two. Now I can go online, click on the UNT archives, go right into what I need, and my biggest problem is I get lost in it. It's like I'll flip to the next page. Oh, look at that ad. Oh, remember that bar? Oh, remember when that store was on Cedar Springs? Oh, remember? Oh, yeah, I'm doing this. That happened that same week. I can't believe. And I waste more time now just scrolling through other history. But I can still do it faster than I could get that one article that I needed. I mean, in one time it was like, oh. So it followed up in June, back down to the library, need the June 1990 whatever, click, 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 got it, here they are back. And
so what, is there a website, or how does somebody who's not a UNT access this?
Well, all the LGBT historic materials that we've digitized, including the Dallas Voice, are available either in both places, the portal to Texas History, texashistory.unt.edu, and in the UNT Digital Library. And if you just Google either one of those, it'll pull them up very easily, and you can get right into them. And anybody in the world can search through those collections and access them for free.
And can you talk a little bit about, as we talked about before the show, the archiving of this history is not just limited to publications.
I'm sorry.
It's not just limited to publications.
Oh, not at all. Absolutely. The things we have in the collection are, letters.
Photos.
Photographs, thousands of photographs and letters, and there's video and there's audio. We're in the midst of talking to Turtle Creek Corral. We're going to be putting up all of their recordings in the portal and in the UNT Digital Library. It can be all types of things like that. And also, minutes, like, you know, someone like the Circle of Friends or some of the very early LGBT nonprofits that formed to support the community, the papers and the history of those organizations are also things that we're really interested in.
And when you say, like, the Turtle Creek Corral putting up all their recordings, it's like, well, isn't that just music? But no, one of the pieces that they had commissioned actually won an Emmy Award, because it was such a powerful telling of what happened during the AIDS epidemic to this one group. I mean, it was just incredibly personal. I can't watch it because it's so upsetting. But it was that good. It was that good. So the music before it, it's what built up to this, and since then, where it's led since then. But, I mean, that is one piece of Dallas history that's incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I want to get back to one thing David said earlier in his story, which is those issues that were lost. If history's not preserved, it's gone forever. Luckily there's paper backups of those, and so we have those issues. But it happens all the time, every day, in someone's house when it burns, or a hurricane comes through, or tornadoes. Somebody passes away and, the family throws things away. So history is being lost all the time, whether it's a physical format, whether it's a digital format. They're all so precarious. So partnering with a library that, it is our mission, it is our values to preserve history, and we've been doing it for centuries. And so we, have a pretty good leg up on how that should be done, and making sure that these things are going to be available 100 years from now, 300 years from now. Somebody can look back and, maybe they'll be listening to this radio show on some digital platform somewhere, right?
Yeah. We talked about how the school, UNT, was very receptive to this. Mission, could you talk a little bit about how is it when you go out and try and get money from people, and do you tell them what it's for? How are they? What is their response?
You will be surprised, because I think, and we talked about this a little earlier, Dallas is not what people perceive it to be.
Right.
When you start having a conversation, you start talking about preserving history. I don't necessarily dive in and say, oh, we're raising funds to support the LGBT collection. I talk about preserving history as a whole. And then I go into the LGBT collection, and there are several other collections at UNT. Folks are open to it, because it's not about, I mean, really, they look at it as we're preserving the history of this class, we're preserving the history of this organization or this news station. They look at it as we're preserving history, period. And history, whether it's LGBT or something else, it's part of Dallas. It's part of North Texas. So folks are very receptive to supporting the work of the libraries. And as a whole, UNT. I mean, they embrace the work that UNT is doing that other institutions may not be doing or want to even do.
That's awesome. Have the students, like, reached out to you all, just told you how, you know, they're excited? I guess some of the LGBT students up at UNT.
Well, UNT is, like Mershem said, very diverse. And actually, of the 1,000 or so student organizations on campus, the very largest one is UNT's GLAAD student organization. Hmm. You know, I think they have over 400 members on campus.
Oh, wow.
You know, they actually, you know, identifying mm-hmm. and are engaging with them. And so, you know, we've reached out quite a bit. We do a lot of partnerships with the Pride Alliance at UNT, which is for support for, you know, our LGBT students. And also, you know, we just last, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, had Outrageous Oral, you know, on the road version. You know, Dallas Wade's been doing this for a long time. And once a year, they come up to UNT, and we get some great folks that have been in the community a long time, but every year we also have at least 2 students that tell their stories. So, you know, students come in to hear that and listen to that, and you know, people, you know, some of our allies on campus are sending, you know, their classes in to hear that.
That's awesome.
Pridge,
yeah.
Tell us about Outrageous Oral. Where did that get going? What is it?
Bruce Monroe is the one who came up with it, and it actually came from sort of a play on words from, I believe, the MAC. The Art Center started doing it, and theirs are more practiced than ours are, but it was a way for people to come and tell their story from their perspective, and it's been phenomenally successful. It's the one thing that we do very well, because people are anxious to talk about themselves, for one thing, and we have so many heroes in here in Dallas that want to tell their story, and they need to get it out, and we want them to do that.
And I've done one, but if you're looking for somebody to talk,
okay.
For people listening on the radio and not watching the video of this, I just volunteered, Laron.
One of the things that we're finding is that those of us who were around in the 80s and before, we all have very clear memories of that. And so I think it changed us all in ways unimaginable.
Laron, shut up. He's about to say, oh, David doesn't have a clear memory of that.
I think, to tell you the truth, I think David was probably 12. I mean, you know, the guy doesn't age. But we're trying to bring in a younger generation, because so many people don't understand, mm-hmm. and they don't know, you know, what it was like back then.
Right.
And whoever said, you know, those who fail to, you know, learn their history are doomed to repeat it. And I just think it's important that they know that. Mm-hmm. So.
How often does Outrageous Oral do you all put on show?
We've been doing it quarterly.
Quarterly, okay.
We are thinking next year maybe only doing 3 a year, and including UNT. So we try.
It's held at the Rose Room, mm-hmm. and it's a wonderful venue for it. It fills with people. It's just usually pretty packed. They're really a lot of fun. Patty did one,
right,
and
yeah.
You did one, Pridge, before the parade just a month or so ago. They're a lot of fun to do, and they're a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah.
But it's real interesting history, because some of the people who've been on are not the usual people that you would expect to be on and speak, and so people that you don't know necessarily, and it all adds to the color and diversity and variety perspectives of what...
Well, it's like we were saying earlier, everybody in the community is not necessarily always involved in the community. That doesn't mean that they don't have stories.
Exactly. Everybody has a story Everybody has a story. And they're extraordinary stories. I mean, I think I've only ever missed two because I've been out of town. This is Drianna. And they're just amazing. You know, I've been moved to tears. I've laughed my butt off. And they're just... And amazing, and you know, to hear someone like Jack and George, you know, tell their story about what was it like to be gay in Dallas in the 50s. I mean, the fact that I think it's so hilarious that, you know, Neiman's was the place that you would go out and walk around the sidewalks to, you know, scout for, you know, folks.
And yet, George or Jack, it was Jack who was fired from Neiman's because he was gay.
How ironic.
So,
how ironic is it, really? Yeah.
So. You know, interesting stories and stories about some of the parties that were held and the police raids of these parties. So lots of that. One of the things that you have are lots and lots of photographs. Most photographs, people don't document what the photographs are. How are you not how you're preserving them. You're preserving them digitally. But how are you putting these into any kind of context?
Well, this happens a lot with historic photographs because you think about over time, you know, they change hands, and this is just for any type of historical photo collection. You know, information's lost because the people that were around it and created it, you know, may not be around anymore to tell you what happened. One of the things that I think, you know, so we do the best we can with the context of what we do know about it. Sometimes you have a set and you can garner clues from what is going on in other photographs to say this was a, you know, a parade in Washington, D.C. in this year. But one of the great things that we can do, because we do have technology, is as we put these things online in our digital library, in the Portal to Texas History or the UNT Digital Library, anybody looking at it that knows something about this photograph can hit a feedback button and leave us comments. And it happens all the time. And if it's a legitimate you know, comment from someone that we can research and we will update records and add people's names. It happens all the time.
What you'd like people to do is not just to go back to browse, not just people who are using it for research, but if you might have been in some of these photographs that Resource Center donated or the Dallas Voice donated, go through this and start scrolling through and send a note, hey, I was there.
Right, exactly.
And explain what the circumstances of that picture is.
Right, and we answer every email that we get from folks. So we love to get those, and especially when it's got great contextual information, we can then add to that record and make it more significant and useful.
Okay, so again, this is money.
Yes, it's money.
How much does it cost to digitize and preserve a photo with information in it?
It's about $5 because, you know, it's a process. We, you know, we hire we're one of the libraries are one of the largest employers of students on campus. And we hire just for our digital projects lab, probably about 30-40 students. And they sit there and they're really the little army out there that's scanning these photographs and scanning documents and describing them at the first level. So it does take money. And it's also just the quality, capturing the very high quality digital masters, so that, you know, years down the road, if you want to blow it up to, you know, bigger than life size for an exhibit somewhere, we can do that. So capturing the really great high resolution and also preserving it, because digital preservation is a big part of it. Like you said, digital information is easy to lose. We intend to never lose our information, and we've got a lot of great strategies and research that we've put into that area as well.
I just had to chuckle because she's right. My very first job in college was at the library.
Wow.
And we used to help put things on microfiche. I'm dating myself. Do they even use microfiche anymore?
They still use it.
Wow. Okay.
Well, I have a better example. I went back to my school maybe 5 years after I graduated, but VHS and Beta had come out by that time. And we had recorded this big event that we had done, and so I was in their digital library, basically, and asked about seeing it, and somebody looked at me, a student, because I was an old person then, 5 years after graduation. Oh, that used old technology. We don't use that anymore.
Oh, yes.
Obviously, a lot of the technology we have now, it'll be out of date 5 years, 25 years, something from now. How do you keep all this so that people can continue to access it?
Well, there's a lot of different strategies, and, you know, we've done research at national level with Library Congress and also internationally with a lot of different groups, and so it's something we take very seriously because we do intend to scan something once, scan it right, and have it available 100 years from now. And the ways we do that is the very high-quality digital masters that we're capturing, we don't store those in just one place. We store those in two diverse geographic locations. It's a huge amount of data. It's like 300 terabytes of data now that we have, and it's always growing. So it's very huge. And then also the thing is about when you have a preservation format that's good for today, for 2015, you know, it may be something different in 2020. So then we're going to migrate that format to the new format and migration of data over time. And the way that we do that in a way we're ensured that it's not being corrupted, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we do that. We assign, you know, different codes to them so that we can tell, like, if a pixel has changed, we know that. And we also run fixity checks against our data at least once a year to say, is everything the way it should be? Oh, yes, well, these things aren't, so then we can go dig them out of one of our other archives to get the pure copy if something was
okay,
wrong.
Okay, so it sounds like the Photoshopped copies that we're going to be sending you of of our show, they're going to un-Photoshop, and I don't like the sound of some of this. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON-FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laron Landis. Our guests today are from UNT, Driana Belden and Mershem George, and from the Dallas Way, Pridge. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Hi, this is Patty Fink, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And Patty Fink will be back with us hopefully in a week, 2 weeks. She's down in New Orleans taking care of her father-in-law. And we are talking about history. UNT has taken on the project of storing North Texas history, and you actually have a number of different groups. You have LGBT history, you have Hispanic history in the area. What are some of the other groups that you have?
Texas history, absolutely. We've got some really significant things from Texas's history, you know, going back pretty far. And so anything basically that, you know, that's a big collection focus for us, but
small town newspapers.
Or big town newspapers, yes. We have digitized over 3 million newspaper pages dating from 1828 to the present, including the Dallas Voice, and, you know, Oklahoma and Gailey's going to join that soon as well. We digitized so much content that every month we're uploading 100,000 new digital files every month.
Give
you an idea of the reach, the Portal to Texas History has over 600,000 uses a month from all over the world. And the UNT Digital Library is ranked as one of the top. It changes every 6 months, but by this national research body in Spain, it's ranked as one of the 10, varies between 10 to 15 top digital repositories in North America, or up there with like MIT and the UC, University of California system. I mean, it's a really good platform.
Do you ever, do you know if anyone who wrote the book, the public school Texas history books, have access the portal?
They do all the time because we reach out to teachers. We actually have lesson plans that we've created for teachers that are free. They can download and use whatever components. Because, I mean, having access to a primary resource, I mean, you can read about history or you can read a letter from, you know, William Barrett Travis.
I think what Pridge was really asking was, are teachers actually allowed to use it? In Texas.
They do all the time. Yeah, we hear from them all the time. And
and they're not fired for actually teaching actual history?
Well, she doesn't know that for sure. I would just ask that question in reference to the fact that, you know, at the moment, the hot topic is that Texas history books contain information about
a lot of disinformation.
A lot of disinformation.
It's a terrible, terrible textbook.
Okay, so you know who we should have on as a guest? One of the founders of Texas, Moses.
Yeah.
Well, that's in the Texas history books
and,
right now.
Yeah, and the Ten Commandments, which are. Yeah. Actually, the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. I think that's important that you do that.
Do you know what my favorite thing in Austin, talking about incorrect history, the monument on the Capitol of the Ten Commandments actually lists 11. You have to look. You have to look at that. I have pictures up of it on Dallas Voice. It lists 11 commandments. Calls them the Ten Commandments, but it's divided number 10 into two. So there are 11 there. It's my favorite thing about that monument. It's actually very incorrect.
Surprising. So, yeah, yeah.
It's their version.
Yeah, but Texas history teachers, like so many other teachers, are just passionate about educating their students. So they really do. We hear from them all the time, and they do use the portal a lot, and they love it. They love it.
I have to, my husband's a school teacher, a history teacher, so I'll have to send him there. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, surprisingly to those who may not know, is that North Texas is home to some of the big landmark LGBT legal cases, like the first sodomy case originated here. Before Lawrence v. Texas, it was the Buckheimer case. Have you gotten any like opinions or documents, some of those sent to you yet that you know of?
I was going to say the Buckmeyer case, one of the originals that was printed out when Jerry Buckmeyer gave his decision. The only way that you could read those decisions, now we're on SCOTUS blog, and if we have to wait 3 minutes to find out what it means, but it used to be that you went down to the courthouse, you got copies of the decision, and hopefully somebody would give it to you, and so you could read that decision within a week or two. But I know that one of the originals that Crossroads Market had copied off down at the courthouse was in the was in all the stuff that we had that time when there was a you had a big exhibit.
Right.
When we opened the resource. Why is my math working this afternoon? When we opened the Resource Center collection.
Exactly. Yeah, and I know the number of those landmark cases are documented in the collection, and if they aren't, we definitely are working with Dallas Way. Is very the folks that are on that board are very cognizant of what are the most important cases that really. And I know they're working very with all the community to get those types of things in. So.
Pam Buckmeyer, who was Judge Buckmeyer's, I can't talk either. Daughter has all of his papers and is planning on giving it to us.
So that's awesome. That's awesome.
UNT.
Yeah.
We're real excited about that.
Sure. One of the things that I remember was that exhibit, which was a lot of fun because in one of the cases, there was a picture of me and Cece from like 1992. And I said, Cece, come on over here. We're an artifact.
Yes. We're part of history.
Have you done any other exhibits with any of the stuff from the...
We haven't yet. This is UNT's 125th anniversary, so I know our exhibit right now is all about UNT's 125th history and the history of the institution. But definitely, I know that exhibit is online, so at any time someone can go look at that. And I know in the future we probably would like to do that. I know Resource Center has mentioned that when they open their new facility, they want to have some sort of exhibits up, with things that come from the collection. So we're going to work with them on that as well.
Oh, great. So you can put together exhibits not just for your own library, but that can actually some of this can be lent out.
Exactly. Or, reproductions of things like a museum exhibit. Often they create reproductions of photos, and definitely those could be, lent to somebody to do that type of thing with.
Great.
That actually just brings me to another question. Has there been any talk about a possible LGBT museum that anybody knows of?
Actually, we have talked about having a, if not a museum, at least a storefront where we can have exhibits like this on a regular kind of basis. We're not there yet. We're a little young, and but that is a goal that we're truly looking at. It takes money.
Well, and I was going to say, we have some good fundraisers here.
We do. And I was actually thinking as I'm standing here, I'm like, okay, well, we're just talking about the history and where things came from. Drianna's talking about how UNT is preserving this history. But we also need the philanthropic support from our community to help make all of this continually happen. As the archives continue to grow, there's going to be a need. So we are actually hoping that folks will say, okay, I want to get involved. I want to come to the table and help support these causes, primarily the digitization and mm-hmm. support of the LGBT collection. And, of course, UNT Libraries has multiple other avenues for support, but we would love to talk to you guys about how you can get involved.
You know, one of the exhibit spaces that I was thinking would be a wonderful exhibit space not far from Oak Lawn, very accessible, the George Bush Library. I bet they'd be excited about having...
And I just had to point out...
You asked, not me.
Well, if you guys start looking at your museum stuff, I am the current president of the Texas Association of Museums, so I know who you need to talk
there
to
you
if you need some advice.
Awesome.
So.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I mean, just one of the best museums I've ever been to here in Dallas was the Women's Museum. Mm-hmm. I loved it. The African American Museum, I'm like, okay, now it's time for us to have a space also.
Exactly.
So, and the Women's Museum space is not being used. Maybe that could mm-hmm. become that. But, some good ideas here. What would be some good ways, some avenues for Dallas Way to go through to start raising that kind of, you know, they've been getting some good donations, but real philanthropic money that they can put on an exhibit. They can, you know, really put together some stuff that isn't straining the library. It's here, help us with the stuff, but... You know, we're going to pay for this and get it out there. And I'm thinking, Mersham, who can they talk to?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that because we're internally having those same kinds of conversations. You know, one other archive that I'm working with, we're thinking about going to foundations, local foundations. Now, it will be more impactful if we combined several projects and said, okay, this is what we're going to be doing. But that's a conversation that we're trying to really sort out. What is the best angle to go to? Everyone that I've talked to primarily says, well, we have these big Dallas foundations. However, those foundations have their priorities and giving guidelines. So we have to figure out how we need to navigate that. But certainly having the conversation and visiting with those folks in the foundations and their directors can help start the conversation to possibly lead to some support. I mean, even if the foundation doesn't necessarily support, one of their officers may be passionate about saying, okay, I want to get involved in that and I want to back it. But, I mean, collectively, we can sit and have that conversation and continue
Absolutely.
The conversation mm-hmm. and go out and do visits to bring awareness to what we're doing and why it's important to Dallas' history. Mm-hmm.
We have two fundraisers a year. And in addition to that, we always do an ask at the Outrageous Oral events. And it's and it all goes to UNT for digitization. It's so far we've given, I think, $18,000. And they've begun digitizing the Dennis Vercher papers, longtime editor of The Voice. And they are also going to hire a couple of students, I believe.
Absolutely, yeah.
To begin, you know, the other things that we've sent. We've had two of our board members, Mike Anglin and Steve Atkinson, up there saying, you know, here's what the priority is, sort of here's what to do first. So that's all in the works. It's been what's difficult for us, I think, is to describe what digitization is and why it's important. You know, we're not trying to cure childhood cancer. We're not trying to, you know, save the world. Well,
yeah, we are.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, not in a huge way. So that's been a little difficult. But all of the money that we raise goes to UNT for digitization.
And we certainly appreciate it. I mean, I know the money that's coming to us this year, we're hiring two students to work the whole year just to support them digitizing Dallas Way collections that have come to us.
Okay, I want to ask you a little bit. The Dennis Vercher collection, Dennis was the original editor of Dallas Voice, and he passed away in 2006. How big a collection is that of his stuff?
That's a good question, David, and I'm sorry.
I know it's boxes and boxes.
Yeah,
He used to keep all of his notepads,
yes.
And everything was marked. Now, Pridge, you've been in my office, and you saw the piles of mess, right?
Yes.
And the David Taffet papers will never be going to UNT because I can't tell you from one week to the next. If I'm done with it, I literally can't tell you what those notes had anything to do with. They are that disorganized. It's amazing that I have to write a story that week because by next week,
It's gone.
No idea what it was. No idea who I talked to. No idea. I have random phone numbers just scribbled all over.
Yeah,
won't be going
to you.
Yeah. Sorry. I'd love to help. However,
we'll find a way.
As we're sitting here and talking, I'm just thinking about some of our earliest guests that we've had on the show, back just from when I started, which was 2000 or 1999. So, you know, a lot of LGBT groups that don't even exist anymore, and one of them was a gay gun club.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Sounds really odd, but there was one. And, of course, it disbanded fairly quickly.
Gay gun
but for somebody who may have some documents or remember that stuff and they want to get in contact with you all and donate, who do they contact?
Well, there's two different ways. There's a lot of folks that know people on the Dallas Way Board, and they're certainly welcome to go directly to one of them, and they have worked out with us how those collections then make their way up to us. Or if they want, they can just call Morgan Gehringer at UNT, who's the head of our special collections, and she can also work with them to bring that in if that's more convenient for them. Mm-hmm. So either way.
And you know, one thing Dallas Way does, they don't just do the outrageous oral presentations. You're also looking for written
Absolutely. We do
documentation.
We're requesting written stories. All of our board members are tasked with bringing in, you know, a certain number of stories every year.
And literally each group that's existed, whether yes. they're still around or not, just a one-page, what was this group?
Yes, we're doing that. And we're also beginning to videotape people and, you know, putting that together and doing some editing around that. So
we're almost out of time, but I do want you to tell the story. How did the story of the Dallas Buyers Club come from UNT, and it really did?
They heard through the grapevine, I guess, that it was the earliest days when we, you know, maybe we'd had the Dallas, you know, Resource Center collection for about 3 months, and so we were still in the process of organizing it all, and they heard we had it, and so they called and started working with our special collections department, and they spent a lot of time, I know, digging through the collection, trying to find things to help them. So, you know, Morgan Gehringer and some of her staff and some of our students did a lot of work with the researchers from the Dallas Buyers Club to pull together the things that they used for the movie. So, you know.
And right now, I forgot who it is. Is it? It's not the History Channel. It's somebody. One of the other channels like that is working on a documentary called Me and asked me to help fill in some information that they got from Old Dallas Voices. And I was the author of some of those things, and some of them the writer is gone. So they called me, and I've been helping them fill in. And once we find out exactly when this is going to be on, maybe we'll have on the filmmaker on this. But they were using, again, the UNT's archive in order to put together a history for a documentary. And it's a documentary specifically about hate crimes.
Right.
That Dallas Voice had written about. We are just about out of time. I want to thank all of you for being here. The hour flew, as always. Next week, our guest is Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson. She'll be answering. She loves coming on our show because we don't quite ask her questions the way any other news media does. For all of us here at Lambda Weekly, we'll be back next week with more. And have a good week.